small city not far from the state line. I got a room at the Oasis Motel and dined at Dick's Cafe. Afterwards, I went for a stroll. St. George had a nice old-town feel about it, though in fact most of the buildings were new, except for the Gaiety Movie Theater, all seats $2, and Dixie Drugstore next door. The drugstore was closed, but I was brought up short by the sight of a soda fountain inside, a real marble-topped soda fountain, with twirly stools and straws and paper wrappers, the sort in which you tear off one end and then blow, sending the wrapper on a graceful trajectory into the cosmetics department. I was crushed. This must be just about the last genuine drugstore soda fountain in America, and the place was closed. I would have given whole dollars to go in and order a Green River or a chocolate soda and send a few straw wrappers wafting about and then challenge the next person along to a stool-twirling contest. My personal best is 4 full revolutions. I know that doesn't sound much, but it's a lot harder than it looks. Bobby Wintermeyer did 5 once and then threw up. It's a pretty hairy sport, believe me. On the corner was a big brick Mormon church, or temple, or tabernacle, or whatever they call them. It was dated 1871 and looked big enough to hold the whole town. And indeed it probably often does, since absolutely everybody in Utah is a Mormon. This sounds kind of alarming until you realize that it means Utah is the one place on the planet where you never have to worry about young men coming up to you and trying to convert you to Mormonism. They assume you are one of them already. As long as you keep your hair cut fairly short and don't say, "Oh, shit," in public when something goes wrong, you may escape detection for years. It makes you feel a little like Kevin McCarthy in Invasion of the Body Snatchers, but it is also strangely liberating. Beyond the Mormon church, things became mostly residential. Everything was green and fresh after the recent rains. The town smelled of spring, of lilacs and fresh mown grass. The evening was creeping in. It was that relaxed time of day when people have finished their dinners and are just pootling about in the yard or garage, not doing much of anything, in preparation for shortly doing even less. The streets were the widest I've ever seen in any town, even out here in the residential neighborhoods. Mormons sure do love wide streets. I don't know why. Wide streets and lots of wives for bonking. Those are the foundation stones of Mormonism. When Brigham Young founded Salt Lake City, one of the first things he did was decree that the streets be 100 feet wide. And he must have said something similar to the people of St. George. Young knew the town well. He had his winter home there. So if the townspeople ever tried anything slack with the streets, he'd have been onto them right away. Chapter 24. Here's a riddle for you. What's the difference between Nevada and a toilet? Answer: you can flush a toilet. Nevada has the highest crime rate of any state, the highest rape rate, the second highest violent crime rate, it's just pit by New York, the highest highway fatality rate, the second highest rate of gonorrhea, Alaska is the trophy holder, and the highest proportion of transients, almost 80% of the state's residents were born elsewhere. It has more prostitutes than any other state in America. It has a long history of corruption and strong links with organized crime. And its most popular entertainer is Wayne Newton. So you may understand why I crossed the border from Utah with a certain sense of disquiet. But then I got to Las Vegas, and my unease vanished. I was dazzled. It's impossible not to be. It was late afternoon, the sun was low, the temperature was in the high 80s, and the strip was already thronged with happy vacationers in nice, clean clothes, their pockets visibly bulging with money, strolling along in front of casinos the size of airport terminals. It all looked fun and oddly wholesome. I had expected it to be nothing but hookers and high rollers and stretched Cadillacs, the sort of people who wear white leather shoes and drape their jackets over their shoulders. But these were just ordinary folks, like you and me, people who wear a lot of nylon and Velcro. I got a room in a motel at the cheaper end of the strip, showered lavishly, danced through a dust storm of talcum powder, pulled on my cleanest T-shirt, and went straight back out, tingling with clean skin and childlike excitation. After days of driving across the desert, you are ready for a little stimulation, and Las Vegas certainly provides it. Now, in the oven-dry air of early evening, the casino lights were coming on, millions and millions of them, erupting into walls of bilious color and movement, flashing, darting, rippling, bursting, all of them competing for my attention, for the coins in my pocket. I had never seen such a sight. It is an ocular orgasm, a three-dimensional hallucination, an electrician's wet dream. It was just as I had expected it to be, but multiplied by 10. The names on the hotels and casinos were eerily familiar. Caesar's Palace, the Dunes, the Sands, the Desert Inn. What most surprised me, what most surprises most people, is how many vacant lots there were. Here and there among the throbbing monoliths there were quarter-mile squares of silent desert, little pockets of dark calm just waiting to be developed. When you have been to one or two casinos and see how the money just pours into them like gravel off a dump truck, it is hard to believe that there could be enough spare cash in the world to feed still more of them, yet more are being built all the time. The greed of mankind is practically insatiable, mine included. I went into Caesar's Palace. It is set well back from the street, but I was conveyed in on a moving sidewalk, which rather impressed me. Inside, the air was thick with unreality. The decor was supposed to be like a Roman temple or something. Statues of Roman gladiators and statesmen were scattered around the place, and all the cigarette girls and ladies who gave change were dressed in skimpy togas, even if they were old and overweight, which most of them were, so their thighs wobbled as they walked. It was like watching moving jello. I wandered through halls full of people intent on losing money, endlessly, single-mindedly feeding coins into slot machines, or watching the clattering dance of a steel ball on a roulette wheel, or playing games of blackjack that had no start or finish but were just continuous, like time. It all had a monotonous, yet anxious, rhythm. There was no sense of pleasure or fun. I never saw anyone talking to anyone else, except to order a drink or cash some money. The noise was intense. The crank of one-armed bandits, the spinning of thousands of wheels, the din of clattering coins when a machine paid out. A change lady jelloed past, and I got $10 worth of quarters from her. I put one in a one-armed bandit. I had never done this before. I'm from Iowa. Pull the handle and watch the wheels spin and thunk into place one by one. There was a tiny pause, and then the machine spat six quarters into the payout bucket. I was hooked. I fed in more quarters. Sometimes I would lose, and I would put in more quarters. Sometimes the machine would spit me back some quarters, and I would put those in as well. After about 5 minutes, I had no quarters left. I flagged down another ample-hipped Vestal Virgin and got $10 more. This time I won $12 worth of quarters straight off. It made a lot of noise. I looked around proudly, but no one paid any attention to me. Then I won $5 more. Hey, this is all right, I thought. I put all my quarters in a little plastic bucket that said Caesar's Palace on it. There seemed to be an awful lot of them gleaming up at me. But in about 20 minutes, the bucket was empty. I went and got another $10 worth of quarters and started feeding them in. I won some and lost some. I was beginning to realize that there was a certain pattern to it. For every 4 quarters I put in, I would on average get 3 back, sometimes in a bunch, sometimes in dribbles. My right arm began to ache a little. It was boring, really, pulling the handle over and over, watching the wheels spin and thunk, 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 spin and thunk, thunk, thunk. With my last quarter, I won $3 worth of quarters, and was mildly disappointed because I had been hoping to go for dinner, and now here I had a mittful of quarters again. So I dutifully fed the quarters into the machine and won some more money. This really was getting tiresome. Finally, after about 30 minutes, I got rid of the last quarter and was able to go and look for a restaurant. On the way out, my attention was caught by a machine making a lot of noise. A woman had just won $600. For 90 seconds, the machine just poured out money, a waterfall of silver. When it stopped, the woman regarded the pile without pleasure and began feeding it back into the machine. I felt sorry for her. It was going to take her all night to get rid of that kind of money. I wandered through room after room, trying to find my way out, but the place was clearly designed to leave you disoriented. There were no windows, no exit signs, just endless rooms, all with subdued lighting, and with carpet that looked as if some executive had barked into a telephone, "Give me 20,000 yards of the ugliest carpet you got." It was like woven vomit. I wandered for ages without knowing whether I was getting closer to or further from an exit. I passed a little shopping center, restaurants, a buffet, cabarets, dark and silent bars where people brooded, bars with live music and astonishingly untalented entertainers. And give me some astonishingly untalented entertainers while you're at it. And one large room, in which the walls were covered with giant TV screens showing live sporting events. Major League Baseball, NBA basketball, boxing matches, a horse race. A whole wall full of athletes were silently playing their hearts out for the benefit of the room's lone spectator. And he was asleep. I don't know how many gaming rooms there were, but there were many. It was often hard to tell whether I was seeing a new room or an old room from another angle. In each one it was the same. Long ranks of people dully, mechanically losing money. It was as if they had been hypnotized. None of them seemed to see that everything was stacked against them. It is all such an incredible con. Some of the casinos make profits of $100 million a year. That's the kind of money many large corporations make. And without having to do anything but open their doors. It takes almost no skills, no intelligence, no class to run a casino. I read in Newsweek that the guy who owns the Horseshoe Casino downtown has never learned how to read and write. Can you believe that? That gives you some idea of the sort of level of intellectual attainment you need to be a success in Vegas. Suddenly I hated the place. I was annoyed with myself for having been taken in by it all, the noise and sparkle, for having so quickly and mindlessly lost $30. For that kind of money, I could have bought a baseball cap with a plastic turd on the brim and an ashtray in the shape of a toilet saying, "Place your butt here, souvenir of Las Vegas, Nevada." This made me deeply gloomy. I went and ate in the Caesar's Palace buffet, hoping that some food would improve my outlook. The buffet cost $8, but you could eat all you wanted, so I took a huge amount of everything, determined to recoup some of my loss. The resultant plate was such a mixture of foods, gravies, barbecue sauces, and salad creams that it was really just a heap of tasteless goo. But I shoveled it all down, and then had an outsized platter of chocolate goo for dessert. And then I felt very ill. I felt as if I'd eaten a roll of insulation. Clutching my distended abdomen, I found my way to an exit. There was no moving sidewalk to return me to the street. There's no place in Las Vegas for losers or quitters, so I had to make a long, weaving walk down the floodlit driveway to the Strip. The fresh air helped a little, but only a little. I limped through the crowds along the Strip, looking like a man doing a poor imitation of Quasimodo, and went into a couple of other casinos, hoping they would re-excite my greed and make me forget my swollen belly. But they were practically identical to Caesar's Palace. The same noise, the same stupid people losing all their money, the same hideous carpets. It all just gave me a headache. After a while, I gave up altogether. I plodded back to my motel and fell heavily on the bed, and watched TV with that kind of glazed immobility that overcomes you when your stomach is grossly overloaded and there's no remote control device and you can't quite reach the channel switch with your big toe. So I watched the local news. Principally, this consisted of a rundown of the day's murders in Las Vegas, accompanied by film from the various murder scenes. These always showed a house with a front door open, some police detectives shuffling around, a group of neighborhood children standing on the fringes, waving happily at the camera and saying hi to their moms. In between each report, the anchor man and anchor woman would trade witless quips, and then say in a breezy tone something like, "A mother and her three young children were hacked to death by a crazed axeman at Boulder City today. We'll have a filmed report after these words." Then there would be many long minutes of commercials, mostly for products to keep one's bowels sleek, followed by filmed reports on regional murders, house fires, light airplane crashes, multiple car pileups on the Boulder Highway, and other bits of local carnage, always with film of mangled vehicles, charred houses, bodies under blankets, and a group of children standing on the fringes, waving happily at the cameras and saying hi to their moms. It may only have been my imagination, but I would almost swear that it was the same children in every report. Perhaps American violence has bred a new kind of person, the serial witness. Finally, there was a special report about a man awaiting release from prison, who 10 years before had raped a young woman and then, for reasons of obscure gratification, had sawn off her arms at the elbows. No kidding. This was so shocking, even to the hardened sensibilities of Nevadans, that a mob was expected to be waiting for the man when he was released at 6 a.m. the next day, according to the TV reporter, who then gave all the details necessary to enable viewers to go down and join in. The police, the reporter added with a discernible trace of pleasure, were refusing to guarantee the man's safety. The report concluded with a shot of the reporter talking to camera in front of the prison gate. Behind her, a group of children were jumping up and down and waving hi to their moms. This was all becoming too bizarre for me. I got up heavily and switched the TV to Mr. Ed. At least you know where you are with Mr. Ed. In the morning, I took Interstate 15, south, out of Las Vegas. A long, straight drive through the desert. It's the main route between Las Vegas and Los Angeles, 272 miles away, and it's like driving across an oven hob. After about an hour, I passed over into California, into a shimmering landscape of bleached earth and patchy creosote bushes called the Devil's Playground. The sunlight glared. The far-off Soda Mountains quivered, and distant cars coming towards me looked like balls of fire, so brilliant was their reflection. And always ahead on the road, there was a slick smear of mirage that disappeared as I drew near, and then reappeared further on. Along the shoulder of the road, sometimes out in the desert itself, were cars that had failed to complete the journey. Some of them looked to have been there for a long time. What an awful place to break down. In the summer, this was one of the hottest spots on Earth. Off to the right, over the parched Avawatz Mountains, was Death Valley, where the highest temperature ever recorded in America, 134 degrees Fahrenheit, was logged in 1913. The world record in 1922 in Libya is just 2 degrees higher. But that was the shade temperature. A thermometer lying on the ground in the sun has gone over 200 degrees. Even now, in April, the temperature was nudging 90, and it was very unpleasant. It was impossible to imagine it almost half as hot again. And yet people live out there, in awful little towns like Baker and Barstow, where the temperature often stays over 90 degrees for 100 days in a row, and where they can go 10 years without a drop of rain. I pressed on, longing for clear water and green hills. One good thing about California is that it doesn't take long to find a complete contrast. The state has the strangest geography. At Death Valley, you have the lowest point in America, 282 feet below sea level, and yet practically overlooking it is the highest point in the country, not counting Alaska, Mount Whitney, at 14,494 feet. You could, if you wished, fry an egg on the roof of your car in Death Valley, then drive 30 miles into the mountains and quick freeze it in a snowbank. My original intention was to cross the Sierra Nevadas by way of Death Valley, breaking off from time to time to perform experiments with eggs. But a weather lady on the radio informed me that the mountain passes were all still closed on account of the recent nasty weather. So I had to make a long and unrewarding detour across the Mojave Desert on Old Highway 58. This took me past Edwards Air Force Base, which runs for almost 40 miles along the highway behind a seemingly endless stretch of chain-link fence. It was at Edwards that the space shuttle used to land, and the Chuck Yeager broke the sound barrier. So it's really quite a hotshot place. But from the highway, I couldn't see anything at all. No planes, no hangars, just mile after mile of tall chain-link fence. Beyond the little town of Mojave, the desert ended, and the landscape erupted in smooth hills and citrus groves. I crossed the Los Angeles Aqueduct, which carries water from Northern California to Los Angeles, 50 miles to the south. Even out here, the city's smog was threaded through the hills. Visibility was no more than a mile. Beyond that, there was just a wall of brownish-gray haze. On the other side of it, the sun was a bleary disk of light. Everything seemed to be bled of color. Even the hills looked jaundiced. They were round and covered with boulders and low-growing trees. There was something strangely familiar about them. And then I realized what it was. These were the hills that the Lone Ranger and Zorro and Roy Rogers and the Cisco Kid used to ride around on in the TV shows of the 1950s. I had never noticed until now that the west of the movies and the west of the television were two quite different places. Movie crews had obviously gone out into the real West, the West of buttes and bluffs and Red River valleys, while television companies, being cheap, had only just driven a few miles into the hills north of Hollywood and filmed on the edges of orange groves. Here, clearly, were the very boulders that Tonto, the Lone Ranger's faithful sidekick, used to creep around on. Every week the Lone Ranger would send Tonto off to creep around on some boulders in order to spy on an encampment of bad guys, and every week Tonto would get captured. He was hopeless. Every week the Lone Ranger would have to ride in and save Tonto. But he didn't mind doing that because he and Tonto were very close. You could see it in the way they looked at each other. Those were the days, all right. Now children sit and watch people having their vitals sprayed around the room with a chainsaw and think nothing of it. I know that makes me sound very old and crotchety to all you youngsters out there, but I think it's a pity that we can't have some good, wholesome entertainment like we had when I was a boy, when the heroes wore masks and capes and carried whips and liked other men a whole bunch. Seriously, have you ever stopped to think what strange role models we were given when we were children? Like Superman, here's a guy who changes his clothes in public. Or Davy Crockett, a man who conquered the frontier, fought valiantly at the Alamo, and yet never noticed that he had a dead squirrel on his head. It's no wonder people my age grew up confused and got heavily involved with drugs. My favorite hero of all was Zorro, who, whenever he was peeved with someone, would whip out his sword and with three deft strokes carve a Z in the offending party's shirt. Wouldn't you just love to be able to do that? Waiter, I specifically asked for this steak rare. Slash, slash, slash. Excuse me, but I believe I was here before you. Slash, slash, slash. What do you mean you don't have it in my size? Slash, slash, slash. For weeks, my friend Robert Swanson and I tried to master this useful trick by practicing it with his mother's kitchen knives, but all we had to show for it were some torn shirts and ragged wounds across our chests. And after a time we gave it up as both painful and impossible, a decision that even now I rue from time to time. As I was close to Los Angeles, I toyed with the idea of driving on in, but I was put off by the smog and the traffic, and above all by the thought that in Los Angeles someone might come up to me and carve a Z in my chest for real. I think it's only right that crazy people should have their own city, but I cannot for the life of me see why a sane person would want to go there. Besides, Los Angeles is passé. It has no surprises. My plan was to drive up through the hidden heart of California, through the fertile San Joaquin Valley. Nobody ever goes there. There's a simple reason for this, as I was about to discover. It is really boring. Chapter 25. I woke up quietly excited. It was a bright, clear morning, and in an hour or two I was going to go to Sequoia National Park and drive through a tree. This excited me in a calm, unshowy sort of way. When I was 5, my Uncle Frank and Aunt Fern from Winfield went to California on vacation. This was, of course, before it turned out that Frank was a homo, the old devil, and ran off to Key West with his barber, which rather shocked and upset a lot of people in Winfield, especially when they realized that from now on they would have to drive all the way to Mount Pleasant to get their hair cut. And they sent us a postcard, showing a redwood tree of such enormous girth that a road had been cut right through the base of it. The postcard showed a handsome young couple in a green Studebaker convertible, driving through the tree, and looking as if they were having something approximating a wholesome orgasm. It made an immediate impression on me. I went to my dad and asked him if we could go to California on our next vacation and drive through a tree. And he looked at the card and said, "Well, maybe one day." And I knew then that I had about as much chance of seeing the road through a tree as I had of sprouting pubic hair. Every year my father would call a family powwow, can you believe this, to discuss where we were going on vacation, and every year I would push for going to California and the tree with a road through it. And my brother and sister would sneer cruelly and say that that was a really mega dumb idea. My brother always wanted to go to the Rocky Mountains, and my sister to Florida, and my mother said she didn't care where we went as long as we were all together. And then my dad would pull out some brochures with titles like Arkansas, Land of Several Lakes, and Arkansas, the Show-Nuff State, and Important Vacation Facts About Arkansas, with a foreword by Governor Luther T. Smiley. And suddenly it would seem altogether possible that we might be going to Arkansas that year, whatever our collective views on the matter might be. When I was 11, we went to California, the very state that housed my dream tree. But we only went to places like Disneyland and Hollywood Boulevard and Beverly Hills. Dad was too cheap to buy a map showing the homes of the movie stars, so we just drove around and speculated. A couple of times at breakfast I asked if we could drive up and see the tree with a road through it, but everybody was so dismissive. It was too far away, it would be too stupendously boring for words, it would probably cost a lot of money, that I lost heart and stopped asking. And in fact, I never asked again. But it stayed at the back of my mind, one of my five great unfulfilled dreams from childhood. The others, it goes without saying, were the ability to stop time, to possess the gift of X-ray vision, to be able to hypnotize my brother and make him be my slave, and to see Sally Ann Summerfield without a stitch of clothing on. Not surprisingly, none of these dreams came true. Which is perhaps just as well. Sally Ann Summerfield is a blimp now. She turned up at my high school reunion 2 years ago and looked like a shipping hazard. But now here at last I was about to fulfill one of them. Hence the tingle of excitement as I slung my suitcase in the trunk and headed up Highway 63 for Sequoia National Park. I had spent the night in the little city of Tulare, in the heart of the San Joaquin Valley. This is the richest and most fertile farming country in the world. They grow over 200 kinds of crop in the San Joaquin Valley. That very morning on the local news on TV, they reported that the farming income for Tulare County for the previous year was $1.6 billion. That's the sort of money Austin Rover turns over. And yet it was only the second highest figure for the state. Fresno County, just up the road, was richer still. Even so, the landscape didn't look all that brilliant. The valley was as flat as a tennis court. It stretched for miles in every direction, dull and brown and dusty, and a permanent haze hung on the horizon like a dirty window. Perhaps it was a time of year, or perhaps it was the drought that was just beginning to choke Central California, but it didn't look rich or fruitful. And the towns that speckled the plain were equally dull. They looked like towns from anywhere. They didn't look rich or modern or interesting. Except that there were oranges the size of grapefruits growing on trees in the front yards. I could have been in Indiana or Illinois or anywhere. That surprised me. On our family trip to California, it had been like driving into the next decade. It had all looked sleek and modern. Things that were still novelties in Iowa. Shopping centers, drive-in banks, McDonald's restaurants, miniature golf courses, kids on skateboards were old and long established in California. Now they just looked older. The rest of the country had caught up. The California of 1988 had nothing that Iowa didn't have, except smog, and beaches, and oranges growing in front yards, and trees you could drive through. I joined Highway 198 at Visalia, and followed it as it shot through fragrant lemon groves, ran along the handsome shoreline of Lake Kaweah, and climbed up into the foothills of the Sierra Nevada Mountains. Just beyond Three Rivers, I entered the park, where a ranger in a wooden booth charged me a $5 entrance fee and gave me a brochure detailing the sights beyond. I looked quickly through it for a photograph of a road through a tree, but there weren't any pictures, just words, and a map bearing colorful and alluring names: Avalanche Pass, Mist Falls, Farewell Gap, Onion Valley, Giant Forest. I made for Giant Forest. Sequoia National Park and Kings Canyon National Park are contiguous. Effectively, they are one national park. And like all national parks in the West, it is a good-sized one, 70 miles from top to bottom, 30 miles across. Because of the twisting roads as I climbed up into the mountains, progress was slow, though splendidly scenic. I drove for 2 hours on lofty roads, through boulder-strewn mountains. Snow was still lying about in broad patches. At last I entered the dark and mysterious groves of the giant sequoia, Sequoiadendron giganteum, according to my brochure. The trees were tall, no doubt about it, and fat around the base, though not fat enough to take a highway. Presumably they would get fatter as I moved deeper into the forest. Sequoias are ugly trees. They soar up and up and up, but their branches are sparse and stubby, so they look silly, like the sort of trees three-year-olds draw. In the middle of the giant forest stands the General Sherman tree, the biggest living thing on Earth. Surely the General Sherman was the one I was looking for. "Oh, boy, Chevette, have I got a treat for you?" I called out and patted the steering wheel fondly. When at last I neared the General Sherman, I found a small parking lot and a path leading to the tree through the woods. Evidently it was no longer possible to drive through the tree. This was a disappointment. Name me something in life that isn't. But never mind, I thought. I'll walk through it. The pleasure will last longer. Indeed, I'll walk through it severally. I will stroll and saunter and glide, and if there aren't too many people about, I might well dance around it in the light-footed manner of Gene Kelly, splashing through puddles and singing in the rain. So I banged the car door shut and walked up the trail to the tree. And there it was, with a little fence around it to keep people from getting too close. It was big, all right, tall and fat, but not that tall, not that fat. And there was no hole through its base. You might just have managed to cut a modest road through it, but, and here's the important thing, no one ever had. Beside the tree was a large wooden board with an educational message on it. It said, "The giant General Sherman is not only the biggest tree in the world, but also the biggest living thing. It is at least 2,500 years old, and thus also one of the oldest living things. Even so, it is surprisingly boring, isn't it? That is because it isn't all that tall and all that fat. What sets it apart from other redwoods is that it doesn't taper very much. It stays pretty fat all the way up. Hence, it has a greater bulk than any other tree. If you want to see really impressive redwoods, ones with roads driven through their bases, you have to go to Redwood National Park, way up near the Oregon border. Incidentally, we've erected a fence around the base of the tree to keep you well back from it and intensify your disappointment. As if that were not enough, there is a party of noisy young Germans coming up the path behind you. Isn't life shitty?" As you will appreciate, this is somewhat paraphrased, but that was the gist of it. The Germans came and were obnoxious and unthoughtful, as adolescents tend to be, and stole the tree from me. They perched on the fence and started taking pictures. I derived some small pleasure from wandering in front of the cameraman whenever he was about to click the shutter, but this is an activity from which it is difficult to extract sustained amusement, even with Germans, and after a minute or two I left them there, jabbering away about die Popmusik and das Drugsin and their other adolescent preoccupations. In the car, I looked at the map and was disheartened to discover that Redwood National Park was almost 500 miles away. I could hardly believe it. Here I was, 300 miles north of Los Angeles, and yet I could drive another 500 miles and still be in California. It is 850 miles from top to bottom, about the distance between London and Milan. It would take me a day and a half to get to Redwood National Park, plus a day and a half to get back to where I was now. I didn't have that kind of time. Gloomily, I started the car and drove on to Yosemite National Park, 70 miles up the highway. And what a disappointment that proved to be. I'm sorry to moan, I truly am, but Yosemite was a letdown of monumental proportions. It is incredibly, mouth-gawpingly beautiful. Your first view of the El Capitan Valley, with its towering mountains and white waterfalls spilling hundreds of feet down to the meadows of the valley floor, makes you think that surely you have expired and gone to heaven. But then you drive on down into Yosemite Village and realize that if this is heaven, you're going to spend the rest of eternity with an awful lot of fat people in Bermuda shorts. Yosemite is a mess. The National Park Service in America, let's be candid here, does a pretty half-assed job of running many of the national parks. This is surprising because in America most leisure time activities are about a million times better than anywhere else, but not national parks. The visitor centers are usually dull, the catering is always crappy and expensive, and you generally come away having learned almost nothing about the wildlife, geology, and history of the places you've driven hundreds of miles to see. The national parks are supposed to be there to preserve a chunk of America's wilderness, but in many of them, the number of animals has actually fallen. Yellowstone has lost all its wolves, mountain lions, and white-tailed deer, and the number of beaver and bighorn sheep are greatly depleted. These animals are thriving outside Yellowstone, but as far as the Park Service itself is concerned, they are extinct. I don't know why it should be, but the National Park Service has a long history of incompetence. In the 1960s, if you can believe it, the Park Service invited the Walt Disney Corporation to build a development in Sequoia National Park. Mercifully, that plan was quashed. But others have succeeded, most notably in 1923, when, after a long fight between conservationists and businessmen, the Hetch Hetchy Valley in the northern part of Yosemite, which was said to be even more spectacularly beautiful than Yosemite Valley itself, was flooded to create a reservoir to provide drinking water for San Francisco, 150 miles to the west. So, for the last 60 years, one of the half-dozen or so most breathtaking stretches of landscape on the planet has lain underwater for commercial reasons. God help us if they ever find oil there. The great problem at Yosemite today is simply finding your way around. I've never seen a place so badly signposted. It's as if they are trying to hide the park from you. At most parks, the first thing you want to do is go to the visitor center and have a look at the big map to get your bearings and decide what you want to see. But at Yosemite, the visitor center is almost impossible to find. I drove around Yosemite Village for 25 minutes before I discovered a parking lot, and then it took me a further 20 minutes and a long walk in the wrong direction to find the visitor center. By the time I found it, I knew my way around and didn't need it anymore. And everything is just hopelessly, depressingly crowded. The cafeterias, the post office, the stores. This was in April. What it must be like in August doesn't bear guessing at. I have never been anywhere that was simultaneously so beautiful and so awful. In the end, I had a nice long walk and a look at the waterfalls and the scenery, and it was outstanding, but I cannot believe that it can't be better run. In the evening, I drove on to Sonora, through a tranquil sunset, along sinuous mountain roads. I reached the town after dark and had difficulty finding a room. It was only the middle of the week, but most places were full. The motel I finally found was grossly overpriced and the TV reception was terrible. It was like watching people moving around in front of funhouse mirrors. Their bodies would proceed across the screen, and their heads would follow a moment later as if connected by elastic. I was paying $42 for this. The bed was like a pool table with sheets, and the toilet seat didn't have a sanitized for your protection wrapper on it, denying me my daily ritual of cutting it with my scissors and saying, "I now declare this toilet open." These things become important to you when you have been alone on the road for a while. In a sour mood, I drove into town and went to a cheap restaurant for dinner. The waitress made me wait a long time before she came and took my order. She looked tarty and had an irritating habit of repeating everything I said to her. "I'd like the chicken fried steak," I said.
"You'd like the chicken fried steak?"
"Yes, and I would like French fries with it."
"You want French fries with it?"
"Yes, and I would like a salad with Thousand Island dressing."
"You want a salad with Thousand Island dressing?"
"Yes, and a Coke to drink."
"You want a Coke to drink?" "Excuse me, miss, but I've had a bad day. And if you don't stop repeating everything I say, I'm going to take this ketchup bottle and squirt it all down the front of your blouse."
"You're going to take that ketchup bottle and squirt it all down the front of my blouse?"
I didn't really threaten her with ketchup. She might have had a large boyfriend who would come and pummel me. Also, I once knew a waitress who told me that whenever a customer was rude to her, she went out to the kitchen and spat in his food. And since then, I have never spoken sharply to a waitress or sent undercooked food back to the kitchen, because then the cook spits in it, you see. But I was in such a disagreeable mood that I put my chewing gum straight into the ashtray without wrapping it in a piece of tissue first, as my mother always taught me to do, and pressed it down with my thumb so that it wouldn't fall out when the ashtray was turned over, but would have to be prized out with a fork. And what's more, God help me, it gave me a tingle of satisfaction. In the morning, I drove north from Sonora along Highway 49, wondering what the day would bring. I wanted to head east, over the Sierra Nevadas, but many of the passes were still closed. Highway 49, as it turned out, took me on an agreeably winding journey through hilly country. Groves of trees and horse pastures overlooked the road, and occasionally I passed an old farmhouse. But there was little sign that the land was used for anything productive. The towns I passed through, Tuttletown, Malones, Angel's Camp, were the places where the California Gold Rush took place. In 1848, a man named James Marshall found a lump of gold at Sutter Creek, just up the road, and people went crazy. Almost overnight, 40,000 prospectors poured into the state, And in a little over a decade between 1847 and 1860, California's population went from 15,000 to nearly 400,000. Some of the towns have been preserved as they were at the time. Sonora is not too bad in this regard, but mostly there's not much to show that this was once the scene of the greatest gold rush in history. I suppose this is largely because most of the people lived in tents, and when the gold ran out, so did they. Now most of the little towns offered the customary stretch of gas stations, motels, and hamburger emporia. It was anywhere USA. At Jackson, I found that Highway 88 was open through the mountains, the first open passage through the Sierras in almost 300 miles, and I took it. I had expected that I would have to take the next but one pass along, the infamous Donner Pass, where in 1846 a party of settlers became trapped by a blizzard for several weeks and survived by eating each other, an incident that caused a great sensation at the time. The leader of the group was named Donner. I don't know what became of him, but I bet he took some ribbing whenever he went into a restaurant after that. At any rate, it got his name on the map. The Donner Pass was also the route taken by the first Transcontinental Railroad, the Southern Pacific, the first transcontinental highway, old Route 40, the Lincoln Highway on their 3,000-mile journey from New York to San Francisco. As with Route 66 further south, Route 40 had been callously dug up and converted into a dull interstate highway, so I was pleased to find a back road open through the mountains. And it was very pleasant. I drove through pine-forested scenery, with occasional long views across unpeopled valleys, up and over Mokelumne Peak, 9,332 feet, heading in the general direction of Lake Tahoe and Carson City. The road was steep and slow, and it took me much of the afternoon to drive the 100 or so miles to the Nevada border. Near Woodford's, I entered the Toyabe National Forest, or at least what once had been the Toyabe National Forest. For miles and miles there was nothing but charred land, mountainsides of dead earth and stumps of trees. Occasionally I passed an undamaged house, around which a fire break had been dug. It was an odd sight, a house with swings and paddling pool in the middle of an ocean of blackened stumps. A year or so before, the owners must have thought they were the luckiest people on the planet, to live in the woods and mountains amid the cool and fragrant pines, and now they lived on the surface of the moon. Soon the forest would be replanted, and for the rest of their lives they could watch it grow again, inch by annual inch. I had never seen such devastation, miles and miles of it. And yet I had no recollection of having read about it. That's the thing about America. It's so big that it just absorbs disasters, muffles them with its vastness. Time and again on this trip I had seen news stories that would elsewhere have been treated as colossal tragedies. 12 people killed by floods in the South, 10 crushed when a store roof collapsed in Texas, 22 dead in a snowstorm in the East, and each of them treated as a brief and not terribly consequential diversion between ads for hemorrhoid unguents and cottage cheese. Partly it is a consequence of that inane breeziness common to local TV newsreaders in America, but mostly it is just the scale of the country. A disaster in Florida is regarded in California in the same way that a disaster in Italy is regarded in Britain, as something briefly and morbidly diverting, but too far away to be tragic in any personal sense. I entered Nevada about 10 miles south of Lake Tahoe. Las Vegas had so put me off that I had no desire to go to another sink of iniquity, though I was later told that Tahoe is a really nice place, and not at all like Las Vegas. Now I shall never know. I can tell you, however, that Carson City was just about the most nothing little city you could ever hope to zip through. It's the state capital, but mostly it was just Pizza Huts and gas stations and cheap-looking casinos. I headed out of town on U.S. 50, past Virginia City, and towards Silver Springs. This was more or less the spot where the map used to burst into flames on Bonanza. Remember that? It has been many years since I've seen the program, but I recall Paw and Hoss and Little Joe and the surly-looking one whose name I forget, all living in a landscape that was fruitful and lush, in a western high chaparral sort of way. But out here, there was nothing but cement-colored plains and barren hills and almost no habitations at all. Everything was gray from the sky to the ground. This was to remain the pattern for the next 2 days. It would be difficult to conceive of a more remote and cheerless state than Nevada. It has a population of just 800,000 in an area about the size of Britain and Ireland combined. Almost half of that population is accounted for by Las Vegas and Reno, so most of the rest of the state is effectively just empty. There are only 70 towns in the entire state. The British Isles have 40,000, just to give you some comparison, and some of them are indescribably remote. For instance, Eureka, a town of 1,200 in the middle of the state, is 100 miles in any direction from the nearest town. Indeed, the whole of Eureka County has just 3 towns and a total population of under 2,500, and this in an area of a couple of thousand square miles. I drove for a while across this fearsome emptiness, taking a back highway between Fallon and a spot on the map called Humboldt Sink, where I gratefully joined Interstate 80. This was a cowardly thing to do, but the car had been making odd noises off and on for the past couple of days, a sort of faint clonk, clonk, oh God, help me, clonk, I'm dying, oh God, clonk noise, which wasn't covered in the troubleshooting section of the owner's manual. I couldn't face the prospect of breaking down and being stranded for days in some godforsaken dust hole while waiting for an anti-clonk device to be shipped in from Reno on the weekly Greyhound. In any case, Highway 50, the nearest alternative road, would have taken me 150 miles out of my way and into Utah. I wanted to go a more northerly route across Montana and Wyoming, the Big Sky country. So it was with some relief that I joined the interstate, though even this was remarkably empty. Usually I could see one car in the distance far ahead and one in the distance far behind, considering it was the main artery across the country. Indeed, with a sufficiently capacious fuel tank and bladder, you could drive the whole way between New York and San Francisco without stopping. At Winnemucca, I pulled off for gas and coffee and called my mother to let her know that I hadn't been killed yet, and was doing all right for underwear, a matter of perennial concern to my mother. I was able to reassure her on this score, and she reassured me that she hadn't willed her money to the International Guppy Institute or anything similarly rash. I just like to check. So we were able to continue our respective days with light hearts. In the phone booth was a poster with a photograph of a young woman on it, under the caption, "Have you seen this girl?" She was attractive and looked youthful and happy. The poster said she was 19 years old and had been driving from Boston to San Francisco on her way home for Christmas when she disappeared. She'd called her parents from Winnemucca to tell them to expect her the next afternoon, and that was the last anyone had heard of her. Now she was almost certainly dead, somewhere out there in that big, empty desert. Murder is terrifyingly easy in America. You can kill a stranger, dump the body in a place where it will never be found, and be 2,000 miles away before the murdered person is even missed. At any given time, there are an estimated 12 to 15 serial murderers at large in the country, just drifting around, snatching random victims, and then moving on, leaving behind few clues and no motives. A couple of years earlier in Des Moines, some teenaged boys were cleaning out an office downtown for one of their fathers on a Sunday afternoon, when a stranger came in, took them into a back room, and shot each of them once in the back of the head for no reason. That guy was caught, as it happens, but he could as easily have gone off to another state and done the same thing again. Every year in America, 5,000 murders go unsolved. That is an incredible number. I spent the night in Wells, Nevada, the sorriest, seediest, most raggedy-ass town I've ever seen. Most of the streets were unpaved and lined with battered-looking trailer homes. Everyone in town seemed to collect old cars. They sat rusting and windowless in every yard. Almost everything in town appeared to exist on the edge of dereliction. Such economic life as Wells could muster came from the passing traffic of Interstate 80. A number of truck stops and motels were scattered around, though many of these were closed down, and those that remained were evidently struggling. Most of the motel signs had letters missing or burnt out, so that they said, "Lohnst-er-mot-ul-v-ken-e." I had a walk around the business district before dinner. This consisted mostly of closed-down stores, though a few places appeared still to be in business, a drugstore, a gas station, a Trailways bus depot, the Overland Hotel, hotel, and a movie house called the Nevada, though this proved upon closer inspection also to be deceased. There were dogs everywhere, sniffing in doorways and peeing on pretty much everything. It was cold, too. The sun was setting behind the rough, distant peaks of the Jackson Mountains, and there was a decided chill in the air. I turned up my collar and trudged the half-mile from the town proper to the interstate junction with U.S. 93, where the most prosperous-looking truck stops were gathered, forming an oasis of brightness in the pinkish dusk. I went into what looked to be the best of them, a large café consisting of a gift shop, restaurant, casino, and bar. The casino was small, just a room with a couple of dozen slot machines, mostly nickel ones, and the gift shop was about the size of a closet. The café was crowded and dense with smoke and chatter. Steel guitar music drifted out of the jukebox. I was the only person in the room who didn't have a cowboy hat on, apart from a couple of the women. I sat in a booth and ordered fried chicken. The waitress was real friendly, but she had little open sores all over her hands and arms, and only about 3 teeth, and her apron looked as if she had spent the afternoon butchering piglets. This put me off my dinner a bit, to tell you the truth. And then she brought my dinner, and that put me off eating altogether. It was absolutely the worst food I have ever had in America, at any time, under any circumstances, and that includes hospital food, gas station food, and airport coffee shop food. It even includes Greyhound bus station food, and Woolworth's luncheon counter food. It was even worse than the pastries they used to put in the food dispensing machines at the Register and Tribune building in Des Moines, and those tasted like somebody had been sick on them. This food was just plain terrible, and yet everybody in the room was shoveling it away as if there were no tomorrow. I picked at it for a while, bristly fried chicken, lettuce with blackened veins, French fries that had the appearance and appeal of albino slugs, and gave up, despondent. I pushed the plate away and wished that I still smoked. The waitress, seeing how much I had left, asked me if I wanted a doggy bag. "No, thank you," I said through a thin smile. "I don't believe I could find a dog that would eat it." On reflection, I can think of one eating experience even more dispiriting than dining at that café, and that was a lunchroom at Callanan Junior High School in Des Moines. The lunchroom at Callanan was like something out of a prison movie. You would shuffle forward in a long, silent line and have lumpen, shapeless food dolloped onto your tray by lumpen, shapeless women, women who looked as if they were on day release from a mental institution, possibly for having poisoned food in public places. The food wasn't merely unappealing. It was unidentifiable. Adding to the displeasure was the presence of the deputy principal, Mr. Snoid. It was always stalking around behind you, ready to grab you by the neck and march you off to his office if you made gagging noises or were overheard inquiring of the person across from you, "Say, what is this shit?" Eating at Callanan was like having your stomach pumped in reverse. I went back to the motel feeling deeply hungry and unsatisfied. I watched some TV and read a book, and then slept that fitful sleep you get when all of your body is still and resting, except your stomach, which is saying, "Where the fuck is my dinner? Hey, Bill, are you listening to me? Where the F-U-C-K is my evening sustenance?" Chapter 26. Here, apropos of nothing at all, is a true story. In 1958, my grandmother got cancer of the colon and came to our house to die. At this time, my mother employed a cleaning lady named Mrs. Goodman, who didn't have a whole lot upstairs, but was possessed of a good Catholic heart. After my grandmother's arrival, Mrs. Goodman grew uncharacteristically sullen. Then one afternoon, at finishing time, she told my mother that she would have to quit because she didn't want to catch cancer from my grandmother. My mother soothingly reassured Mrs. Goodman that you cannot catch cancer, and gave her a small pay increase to compensate for the extra work occasioned by my grandmother's clammy and simpering presence. So with ill-disguised reluctance, Mrs. Goodman stayed on. And, about 3 months later, she caught cancer and with alarming swiftness died. Well, as you can imagine, since it was my family that killed the poor woman, I've always wanted to commemorate her in some small way, and I thought that here would be as good a place as any, especially as I had nothing of interest to tell you about the drive from Wells, Nevada, to Twin Falls, Idaho. So goodbye, Mrs. Goodman. It was nice knowing you, and we're all very, very sorry. Twin Falls was a nice enough place. Mrs. Goodman, I've no doubt, would have liked it.
But then when you think about it, a dead person would probably appreciate any change of scenery. And the landscape in southern Idaho was greener and more fertile than anything Nevada had to offer. Idaho is known for its potatoes, though in fact Maine, just a third its size, produces more. Its real wealth comes from mining and timber, particularly in the higher reaches of the Rockies, up towards Canada, over 500 miles north of where I was now. I was headed for Sun Valley, the famous resort up in the Sawtooth Mountains, and the neighboring town of Ketchum, where Ernest Hemingway spent the last year of his life and blew his brains out. This has always seemed to me, not that it's any of my business, mind you, a particularly thoughtless and selfish way to kill oneself. I mean to say, your family is going to be upset enough that you were dead, without your having to spoil the furniture and gross everyone out on top of that. In any case, Ketchum was touristy, though Sun Valley itself proved to be most agreeable. It was purpose-built as a ski resort in the 1930s by the Union Pacific Railroad, as a way of enticing people to travel to the region during the winter. It certainly has a beautiful setting, in a bowl of jagged mountains, and is supposed to have some of the best skiing in the country. People like Clint Eastwood and Barbara Streisand have houses there. I looked in a window in a real estate office and didn't see anything for sale for less than $250,000. The town part of Sun Valley, it's really just a little shopping center, is built to look like a Bavarian village. I found it oddly charming. As so often with these things in America, it was superior to a real Bavarian village. There were two reasons for this. One, it was better built and more picturesque. And two, the inhabitants of Sun Valley have never adopted Adolf Hitler as their leader or sent their neighbors off for gassing. Were I a skier, and rich, I would on these grounds alone unhesitatingly choose it over Garmisch-Partenkirchen, say. In the meantime, being poor and skiless, there was nothing much for me to do but poke around in the shops. For the most part, these sold swish skiing outfits and expensive gifts, things like large pewter elk for $200 and lead crystal paperweights at $150. And the people who ran them were those snooty types who watch you as if they think you might do a poo in the corner given half a chance. Understandably, this soured me on the place, and I declined to make any purchases. Your loss, not mine, I murmured sniffily as I left. Idaho is another big state, 550 miles from top to bottom, 300 miles across at the base, and it took me the rest of the day just to drive to Idaho Falls, near the border with Wyoming. En route, I passed the little town of Arco, which on December 20th, 1951, became the first town in the world to be lit with nuclear-powered electricity, supplied by the world's first peacetime nuclear reactor at a site 10 miles southwest of town at the Idaho National Engineering Laboratory. The name is misleading because the so-called laboratory covers several hundred square miles of scrubby chaparral and is actually the biggest nuclear dump in the country. The highway between Arco and Idaho Falls runs for 40 miles alongside the complex, but it is lined by high fences interspersed with military-style checkpoints. In the far distance stand large buildings where presumably workers in white spacesuits wander around in rooms that look like something out of a James Bond film. I didn't realize it at the time, but the U.S. government had recently admitted that plutonium had been found to be leaking from one of the storage facilities on the site and was working its way downward through the ground to a giant subterranean reservoir which supplies the water for tens of thousands of people in southern Idaho. Now, plutonium is the most lethal substance known to man. A spoonful of it could wipe out a city. Once you make some plutonium, you have to keep it safe for 250,000 years. The United States government had managed to keep its plutonium safe for rather less than 36 years. This, it seems to me, is a convincing argument for not allowing your government to mess with plutonium. And this was only one leak out of many. At a similar facility in the state of Washington, 500,000 gallons of highly radioactive substances drained away before anyone thought to put a dipstick in the tank and see how things were doing. How do you lose 500,000 gallons of anything? I don't know the answer to that question, but I do know that I would not like to be the real estate agent trying to sell houses in Pocatello or Idaho Falls 5 years from now when the ground starts to glow and women are giving birth to human flies. For the time being, however, Idaho Falls remains an agreeable little city. The downtown was attractive and still evidently prospering. Trees and benches had been set out, A big banner was draped across one of the streets saying, "Idaho Falls says no to drugs." That's really going to keep the kids off the hard stuff, I thought. Small-town America is obsessed with drugs. Yet I suspect that if you strip-searched every teenager in Idaho Falls, you would come up with nothing more illicit than some dirty magazines, a packet of condoms, and a half-empty bottle of Jack Daniels.
Personally, I think the young people of Idaho Falls ought to be encouraged to take drugs. It will help them to cope when they find out there's plutonium in their drinking water. I had an excellent dinner at Happy's Chinese Restaurant. The room was empty except for one other party, consisting of a middle-aged couple, their teenage daughter, and a Swedish exchange student who was simply radiant, blonde, tanned, soft-spoken, hypnotically beautiful. I stared at her helplessly. I had never seen anyone so beautiful in a Chinese restaurant in Idaho before. After a while, a man came in who was evidently a passing acquaintance of the family and stopped at their table to chat. He was introduced to the Swedish girl and asked her about her stay in Idaho Falls and if she had been to the local sites, the lava caves and hot springs. She had. They were very nice. Then he asked the big question. He said, "Well, Greta, which do you like better, the United States or Sweden?" The girl blushed. She obviously had not been in the country long enough to expect this question. Suddenly she looked more child than woman. With an embarrassed flutter of hand, she said, "Oh,